From a leadership change in our area's largest school district to the collapse of a bridge in a major shipping hub, ape and gorilla deaths at the Jacksonville Zoo, and more. WOKV covered it all throughout 2024. Saying his Florida roots were a top selling point, Dr. Christopher Bernier gets unanimous approval from the Duval County School Board to be its incoming superintendent.
This is an amazing opportunity and a chance to continue to grow as a superintendent and do the best work possible on behalf of the students in this community.
He was the chair of the vocal department at Douglas Anderson for almost 23 years. Now, Clayton was arrested and since has pleaded guilty to four charges stemming from allegations of sexual misconduct with students.
Josue Garriga's family members took the stand yesterday to ask the judge for mercy. The 17-year-old victim's mother was also in court. We're told the victim is getting treatment related to her encounters with Garriga. Garriga's attorney spoke after court.
He's accepted responsibility. He came into the courtroom well before today and acknowledged that he had done wrong.
From the sixth floor, it's black smoke. Wherever that smoke is coming from, it's rolling fast.
I don't know, word on what exactly caused this fire, something that officials will be investigating. While there's a lot of factors that go into that, it's hard to do that right now because they cannot get into the apartment complex, get inside the building. This is the reason why. You can still see all the crews that are surrounding this apartment complex. You're still able to see the ladders here, the damage. Now, Chief Powers mentioned there's a possibility it could collapse.
Local businesses like Intuition Ale Works have been unable to open, and street access on East Adams has been blocked off as the instability of the structure makes it a risk to public safety. In a statement, Mayor Donna Deegan told us, quote, as a seven-story structure with significant damage, the Rise Doro apartments pose an immediate threat to the surrounded area and businesses.
The policy prohibits material considered defamatory or vulgar or could incite violence. I asked the district why it does not include board members and the repercussions for violations, but was instead told the item was removed from Monday night's agenda and is expected to return in January.
There's a big question mark around that, so I think if they're going to take the time to be fine-tuning these policies for district staff and our teachers, they absolutely need to be just copy and paste and make it applicable to board members.
Starting January 1st, Florida was supposed to begin levying fines of $50,000 per violation on social media companies if they failed to remove users under the age of 14. The law also prohibits 14 and 15-year-olds from accessing social media platforms without parental consent. However, a new court filing shows the state's attorney general agreed to delay enforcement until a federal judge makes a decision on whether the law should be blocked while the case against it moves through the courts.
Six Board of Commissioners voted unanimously to hire former JHA Chair Rosalind Mixon Phillips as interim chief executive officer. Mixon Phillips is expected to take the reins as early as this week, pending a standard background investigation and a finalization of a contract. Terms of her employment include serving as interim for up to 1 year with three-month reviews and an annual salary of up to $200,000.
This is the third resignation at the Jacksonville Housing Authority this past month. Board Chairman Christopher Walker resigned last Wednesday, citing a new opportunity that conflicted with staying on the board. And the week before that, Andre Green submitted his resignation. Sources say the IG is looking into Harriet Brock. She's the secretary and also a resident member of the board. Now, sources tell me she's exceeding income requirements for Section 8 housing. It's because family members have moved in with her. That's what the sources tell me. I reached out to Brock, who says she has no knowledge of an investigation.
The message from everyone who spoke today is clear. They all want to keep the state parks beautiful and exactly the way they are. So all the beaches mayors, Jacksonville City Councilman Rory Diamond, and other local leaders came together to oppose the state's proposal to develop part of Anastasia State Park. That Florida Department of Environmental Protection's plan calls for the construction of a 350-room lodge within the park, which would be the second largest hotel in St. Johns County.
Nothing has been approved, and they are going to go back and listen to folks. And as I said, as governor, I am totally fine to just do nothing and do no improvements if that's what the general public wants, and that's fine with me.
A judge sentenced Aaron Zahn to 4 years in prison, followed by a year of supervised release. Zahn faced a maximum of 9 years in prison. During the hearing, Zahn's attorneys pushed back on a multi-year sentence, citing Zahn's diagnosis of PTSD. In a statement, JEA says, quote, "Today's sentencing closes a painful chapter for our employees and the community we serve. We are thankful for the members of law enforcement, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the criminal justice system for all of their hard work."
After weeks of debate, NASA decided in the name of safety that it's just too risky to send those astronauts down in the Boeing Starliner after lingering concerns of multiple helium leaks and problems with their thrusters. Astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, they've been stuck at the International Space Station since the beginning of June and will now come back in that SpaceX capsule in February.
Sinking. The bridge is gone.
Bobby Gaddis, who lives in the area, posted video on social media. They call it the Key Bridge.
An enormous number of emergency vehicles coming down this way.
It's unbelievable video at WOKV.com. The bridge, a vital artery that, along with the Port of Baltimore, is a hub for shipping on the East Coast.
3-year-old Kevin the gorilla was born here at the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens. Tragically, zoo officials say after nearly a month of intensive treatment for a bacterial infection called Shigella, Kevin passed away on Sunday.
Every loss is hard, but with Kevin, because he was so young and because we invested so much trying to save him, it was particularly hard.
Kevin's death comes roughly 2 weeks after the Shigella outbreak claimed the lives of bonobos Jumanji and Jenga, as well as Kevin's grandmother, Balera.
We have scored a touchdown.
Marking the end of 8 months of negotiation and years of planning, the city's commitment is $831 million.
It includes $775 million for the stadium in time for the Jags' 2028 season. The vote was 14-1.
Mayor Donna Deegan vowing to work to fully fund that community benefits agreement to benefit the East Side and other programs.
My goal is to lift every portion of this city, and I think that we can do that.
This is making me proud to be a Jacksonville citizen. Let's not go for a field goal, let's go for a touchdown. And I feel like this stadium is probably the biggest investment I will ever see in our city.
Duval. Yes, sir. We're bringing the Super Bowl in, and we're just excited about the deal.
What I see is an iconic shape that will really define and identify with Jacksonville. You'll see that in the future, whether it's from 30,000 feet or from 10 feet, and you'll know you're in Jacksonville. It's great fan experience, environmentally friendly, and done in a great way for efficiency as well as great aesthetics and fan experience.
I heard you mention earlier keeping the video boards. That was a taxpayer investment. What other taxpayer investments and Jaguars investments, Shad Khan investments, will be kept throughout the process so that this is smart use of taxpayer money?
Exactly.
And your money.
Yes, and my money. I mean, that's a great thing with private-public partnership that, it works great because we're worried about money, period. So there are many examples. We're using the lower bowl, okay? Lower bowl, if you had to reproduce it, would be probably $500 million plus. And then look at the environmental damage it does, okay? Concrete is a big polluter, probably one of the biggest polluters in the world. So you're looking at, destroying the concrete, going it to a landfill, and then redoing it all over again. Why? So what can be done with site angles and things like that? Certain, principles about ratios and what have you are classical, going back to the Greek days, okay? And I used the example this morning about the, Roman Colosseum. So we looked at what is good, what is timeless, what can work. And this stadium, even probably 5 years ago, probably would not have been possible. I think the reflective chrome film technology. I mean, it's solar. It got developed over the last 5 years. It's proven UV and what have you, where we feel comfortable doing it. You know, if you were doing it, metal cladding be prohibitively expensive, be beautiful, but, you know, be just wouldn't be economically feasible.
Yeah, when you look 30 years out, you want your kids, grandkids, and whatnot to still be able to see this and feel it and be a part of it so that we're not needing to spend another, at that point, billions of dollars down the road. How are you ensuring that that is seen through? And as you look to your children and grandchildren going forward, that they're going to be a part of this future stadium and no longer stadium of the future.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's like it's hot in Jacksonville, especially in September, okay? And we have to deal with it. So you've got to have a roof. And but it's got to be smart roof. You know, you're in Florida, you don't want to be sitting in like a barn that's dark. I mean, what's the point of being in Florida? So we have a roof that we can have different gradients of gray. We know how the sun goes above the stadium, and different shading, so the people get the shade, but then you also have sun on the field, okay? So you feel you're in Florida. You want to be cool, you know, and the solution, obviously, the South got developed because of air conditioning. I mean, so Carrier, when air conditioning got invented in the 20s, is when really South took off. We want people to feel cold, cool and comfortable. Well, you do it, we're doing it with the passive cooling, okay? Not using, doesn't matter how efficient the air conditioners are. No energy involved other than Mother Nature with how the winds move and, you know, go over the people to give them a nice breeze. And a Venturi effect. So, I mean, there are many, many other aspects like
Mayor Donna Deegan, when you were talking about the collaboration and the work that happened in making this happen, how hard will you leverage the Jaguars to get everything past the finish line on the remainder of the community benefits agreement?
Well, I think you heard Mark say last night that if this just is only a stadium, we have missed a really big opportunity. Now, obviously, we got the parks included, which is going to be huge, getting those parks all done and paid for and developed. But the fact that we need to invest in the historic east side, which is going to abut the stadium, incredibly important. The affordable housing aspects, the workforce development. I mean, think of all the projects that we have going on in this city that will be going on at the same time as this construction. You've got this enormous undertaking. You've got the riverfront. You've got the Emerald Trail. You've got all the construction going on, and we don't have the workforce here to make sure that we can do all that. So we need to train those people. These are all aspects which make sure that we can lift the entire community. And as Mark said, that's what will make this truly an historic deal that will lift the entire community of Jacksonville. And that's why I believe that the voices from here on the Jaguar side and from our side at the city are going to carry the day. And we will end up getting that agreement across the finish line.
Shad, will you personally get invested in getting the remaining $94 million passed?
I think, you know, Donna, City Council, you know, we're deferring to them. I mean, our part is funding it. And I think as, you know, Mark Lamping has said, I've said, this is a historic chance for the city to really move the city forward. Jaguars being successful without, and you know, the city being successful, I mean, that is not a good thing, okay? I mean, we both need to really come off better after this than before. And so I think, you know, it's a big part of it, let's face it. I mean, I, you know, the glacial pace over the last 12 years, I think I've talked to the mayor, it's been a little frustrating, but it's really good that we finally have a breakthrough here.
I think we need to make the most of that. I mean, that's really the bottom line here, is that we have the opportunity here to think big, to think bold, to really be the bold new city of the South. And we have the opportunity, because of this catalyst that is the stadium, to make sure that we're taking full advantage of that so that everything else ignites at the same time. We've been waiting and waiting for that development to all, and it's because you have to put the pieces together and you have to invest enough in those pieces to make sure that it all happens. And that's really the idea behind this, Rich.
A lot of discussion went into this with what the future of the London agreement will look like. Yeah. Once that expires, what is your hope for this team and its continued growth overseas to different markets? And how will a new stadium impact those negotiations and your consideration of that?
Well, I think, you know, it goes both ways. I mean, we want to play there. We've developed a fan base overseas. I mean, if you look at significant number of our hits on the website are from overseas. We want those fans coming here and having an experience. I mean, the Jaguars, the stadium will kind of define the game day experience in a way. So, I mean, I'm hoping it's going to go both ways. We can have them here, but we want to grow our fan base. International, part of the Jaguars, I think that's why I've been really delighted. I mean, the mayor going to some of the games, talking to the people and really getting a firsthand look. We want to help bridge maybe job creation, economic growth in Jacksonville, having a presence. And I think, you know, quite by accident, I eavesdropped on Mayor of London and our Mayor of Jacksonville last year on the sideline. And, and it was like, what are they talking about? And Sadiq, the mayor of London, was telling Donna that, 10 years ago, we had no idea what we knew Florida. We had no idea what Jacksonville was. And now Jaguars playing here, everyone knows what Jacksonville is. So the awareness, and really you got to have that before you look at the mutual opportunities.
He can eavesdrop anytime he wants to, but I'll tell you that it's interesting. He always says and has said repeatedly today that actions speak louder than words. And it's one of the things that the mayor of London and I were talking about that day, that it is important to put your actions behind these whole, you know, these wonderful visions. You know, renderings are fantastic, but without the action steps behind them and without some urgency behind those steps, it's not going to happen. And so I think that, you know, that's what you learn from people like that and from people like Schott. I mean, he's pointed out several times today, he wasn't always this great successful business person. There were fits and starts and lessons to be learned, and I think we've certainly had that here. But you got to keep going, and you've got to believe in the vision for your city, and you've got to take the steps to make it happen. And I think that's what's so great about this partnership.
I'll leave you on this, Shad Khan. As you close your eyes at night, can you envision the feel, the sounds, the smells, the atmosphere? First game of 2028, what do you feel when you close your eyes at night and think about that? Have you had a chance to think about that since last time? Maybe?
You know, I think the renderings, the 3D, whatever, you can live the fan experience before it happens. So I think, you know, that's awesome. I think it's going to be, hey, it's like you always have to be thinking next steps. I'd be looking at, hey, how is the city better? Obviously, we have a great competitive environment. Our expectation of the football team, we expect you to win. And every game you go out, we expect you to win. So all of that, I think the vibe, the feeling, not just for me, but I want the city to feel good. Okay, and football, a stadium is just part of it. I think changing the psyche and the self-image and how we feel about it is, frankly, much more important.
This was a 60 to 70 foot tree that fell onto this apartment.
This storm carved across virtually every part of Florida.
Moving people out using high profile vehicles.
That storm made landfall on Siesta Key, a community that was just getting back on its feet from Hurricane Helene. That includes the debris piles.
2024 will forever be remembered for two storms that devastated communities in Florida and other parts of the Southeast United States. Helene and Milton. As our year-end spotlight continues, we bring in First Alert Chief Meteorologist Mike Burrish for a conversation about those two storms and the year in weather headlines. Mike, do you have overall some top takeaways as you reflect back on 2024 in weather?
Wow, that's a good question. Yes, I'm going to remember it as one of those years where if you don't like the weather, just wait a minute. Or if you don't like the skies, just wait a minute. I mean, think about it. We go back to January. We had multiple tornado outbreaks in January and February in Jacksonville and northeastern Florida that included tornadoes on the ground, EF0s, EF1s that did fair amount of damage in St. John's, Clay, and Duval County at one time or another in January and February. So we had the tornado outbreaks. We came into March very wet, coming out of a very wet winter. It stayed pretty wet, and then we dried out like we typically do in April, but that didn't last particularly long. But speaking of April, we were gifted with the heavens and the solar eclipse, which was awesome. So we had that. And of course, I got the opportunity to drive to Totality in Texas and see the full Monty, so to speak. And then we get to late spring and the temperatures start to heat up. We are facing the hurricane season and our wet season was slow to start. So all of a sudden we're dry. And then, of course, come the last week of June, we turn wet. Our wet season turns on. Doesn't stop raining essentially until about October. We had one of the, we're going to end up a solid 10 plus inches above average for the entire year, the majority of that falling in the summer and early fall. We had Beryl come through the Caribbean in late August, late June, early July, an unseasonably powerful early season hurricane, a Cat 5 at one point, devastated parts of the Caribbean islands. Thankfully weakened by the time it got to the Texas coast, but was still a Cat 1. And then we went into that unseasonable silence, so to speak, of the peak of the hurricane season, where we were like, oh, well, maybe this hurricane season is not going to be so bad. Well, you've heard me talk about it all the time. Mother Nature's all about averaging things out. And boy, lo and behold, did it average out with a very active September and October in the tropics, with especially hits including Debbie, which was actually late July, early August. So we did have one kind of incursion, if you will, there earlier in the season. But that was a Cat 1 in the Big Bend. We can handle that. But then, of course, the headlines for the hurricane season will be Helene and Milton in September and early October, which directly impacted Jacksonville and northeastern Florida. Not to be outdone in October by, again, the heavens with the northern lights visible a second time this year. And then we come into November, finally get the hurricane season essentially behind us. It's an unseasonably warm November, the sixth warmest on record, only to start out with a December that had four straight freezes, something that hadn't happened since the 19th century. So you get what I mean by if you don't like the weather, just wait a minute in 2024?
Is there something to the extremes, and is that word too extreme perhaps, that we should anticipate this becoming more the norm?
You know, that's a great question and a great debate. I'm going to tell you that when the weather is not changing suddenly or dramatically and is not extreme, that's the end of the world. Because that's the way the weather's always been. The atmosphere is always trying to balance things. We have ways now to communicate that better than ever. We get instant pictures of weather that's occurring in corners of the world that we otherwise would never hear about or see. I suspect that the weather's not a whole lot more extreme than it's ever been, but we have more people than we've ever had in places that we've ever had and documentation that we would have never otherwise had either. So, in other words, if you had an EF5 tornado roaring across the plains for miles and miles in the 1700s, for example, the Indians didn't take out their Wi-Fi cameras and get pictures of it and then document it and report it. So nor did a big hurricane in the middle of the Atlantic, would it go even be detected back then? So I think there's a lot to say about that. Now, I'm not telling you that the things aren't changing. That's not my point. But my point is, we should always expect extreme weather, and we should always approach it from a mitigation standpoint. And that goes back eons.
With Chief Meteorologist Mike Bursch, the two storms that will go down in the record books, two of the names that will likely be retired, Helene and Milton, from this year. And I think about the threats that we faced initially as the forecast was early on with both of those storms for northeast Florida, and then ultimately what ended up happening and the dramatic impacts that were felt with Helene across multiple states and some communities in North Carolina that are still feeling, and it will be for years, versus Milton, which was a little bit more concentrated, but was still very impactful for so many this year.
Yeah, those are the two standout storms, Noel. And I'll throw, no doubt, and I'll throw in Beryl as a name that'll be retired because of its intensity early on. So you're looking at it's certainly three names that are going to be retired from this list. And interestingly enough, Milton was brand new on the list. It replaced Michael from 2018, which was a devastating Category 5 hurricane that hit the panhandle. Milton now will have to be replaced, no doubt. So, yeah, those are the two standout storms for as far as the U.S. and as far as Florida is concerned. With Helene mid to late September hurricane that moved up the west coast of Florida. I don't think a lot of people understand and realize the devastation on the west coast of Florida that it still remains to this day from Helene. It wasn't a direct hit on the west coast, but the storm surge was very significant from Sanibel Island and Fort Myers northward all the way up through Tampa to the Big Bend. And Cedar Key has been kind of lost in the shuffle because that's a small fishing village. They essentially have never had a big hurricane make landfall there. It's a beautiful little place if anyone's ever been there. They have old hotels and businesses that have been there many, many years that are gutted. And it'll be interesting and questionable as to how much and how quickly they're going to be able to come back in places like Cedar Key. And then, of course, you had the inland impacts of Helene all the way up, as you mentioned, to the Carolinas with devastating mudslides and flooding. And then in Jacksonville and northeastern Florida, it was power outages at 1.25% of Duval County without power after Helene. That kind of pales in comparison to some previous storms, but it was a wake-up call on a storm that was not all that close to Jacksonville and northeastern Florida, but we emphasize it all the time. Rich, you know that. No such thing as Justa. And Helene was weakening as it moved to the north and northeast, but Justa tropical storm still ended up having some pretty profound impacts on Jacksonville and northeastern Florida. And then Milton cuts across the middle of Florida, making landfall in Tampa with some very heavy rain and high winds that extended up into Clay and St. Johns County in particular. So, yeah, it'll be a 2024 hurricane season to remember.
Good morning. You're listening to Jacksonville's Morning News on 104.5 WOKV. You're listening to our special year-end review, where we take a look back at some of our favorite moments to highlight the wonderful community that we're privileged to serve. One of the most exciting decisions that we made this year was to take Jacksonville's Morning News on the road. We wanted to reach out and really dig into what makes our community special, speaking face-to-face with those who live and work in Jacksonville. Our first big outing this year was only 6 months ago at Jacksonville University in mid-June, where we headed out to speak with Dr. Harley Newton, who is our guide through OSearch and JU's partnership and mission to protect sharks in our waters.
What happens here at Jacksonville University? What's OSearch's reach here in the Jacksonville community? And what have we been able to build over the last almost 10 years or so?
Jacksonville University is OSearch's academic home. This academic partnership has been hugely beneficial both to us as well as students that come here and attend Jacksonville University and students in the general region. We were very fortunate in that the city of Jacksonville worked to create a dock that could handle our specialized research vessel, the MV OSearch. And the state of Florida has furthered making this our home base by helping us build what will be the future global headquarters for OSearch at Jacksonville University.
Why is it so important that that global headquarters is here in the Northeast Florida area off this coast?
Florida traditionally has a rich history of shark research that's ongoing all during the year. There's a wonderful group of institutions that study sharks. And, you know, the basis of OSearch is collaboration. We provide a research vessel and we put together teams of scientists to use that vessel to study marine life. We are largely focused on sharks and particularly white sharks, but we also support research by marine mammal scientists and sea turtle scientists, and really are just an access point to the water for those groups. So North Florida is a wonderful location to be. The St. Johns River provides us easy access both to the river and to the Atlantic side. It's just a wonderful location. And this partnership with Jacksonville University has been hugely rewarding for us.
You had that shark question earlier. Ask it again. I love it. I think it's great.
So I noticed on your website you talk about white sharks, and there was no mention of a great white shark. Is there a difference between a great white shark and a white shark?
Right. So that is really just semantics of a common name. There is no lesser white shark, and the scientific community tends to refer to these animals as white shark. Great white shark certainly is an appropriate term for those animals, but it also induces fear, and that's something that we're really trying to get ahead of, trying to replace people's fear with facts about these animals.
I think it's so, I have 8 million questions, but one of them is, I think it's so interesting to see how the health of the sharks reflects the health of the oceans, and that's in fact why you guys are doing this, right? It's one of the reasons why you're studying white sharks.
Yeah, Sharks are important apex predators and keystone species throughout our marine environments. They are important, essentially, canaries in the coal mine of disturbance. They also exert really critical top-down pressures on other predators and prey species that keep our oceans in balance and ultimately keep them healthy. So studying sharks is the way that we contribute to really understanding marine ecosystems and their disturbance, and protecting them is a critical part of that.
So if you understand the health of the sharks, you understand the health of the ocean in which they're living.
You understand the health of the oceans, you understand the health of our fisheries. I mean, there's a lot of livelihoods that rely on the ocean as well. So it isn't just a pure conservation concern. It also is these livelihoods that are so important, particularly in Jacksonville.
Our next outing into the community wouldn't be until almost 3 months later, where we had the privilege to sit in the most acoustically perfect room in the whole city, the Jacoby Symphony Hall of Jacksonville Center for the Performing Arts, the day before our symphony's opening show for the 75th season. This was a personal favorite of mine, where we got to sit down with music director and conductor Courtney Lewis.
Does the renewed interest in symphonic music surprise you, or do you have the opinion, hey, we've been here all along and it's nice that people are rediscovering?
I think it surprised me when I moved here how much people in Jacksonville enjoyed music, because we always had good ticket sales, but I mean, they've been crazy since our wonderful new director of marketing arrived. Every concert is so well sold. It's thrilling to see that the community embraces music in such a great way. But in terms of the actual art form, it doesn't surprise me at all, because this is one of the most dynamic forms of music there is. There's no other genre of music that expresses every nuance of emotion in the way that classical music does. And so often people have misconceptions about it based on not really very much information. You know, they have ideas that it's for rich people or it's for their grandparents. And of course it's not. And it's for everybody. And my single mission over the last decade as to bring the absolute best symphonic music to the absolute maximum number of people in Jacksonville. And it's been great to see that happen over the last few years.
That's lovely. It is the one genre of music that everyone listens to, whether they know it or not.
That's true. And most people know a lot more classical music than you think because of movies. Mm-hmm. They're much more used to its atmosphere. So coming to a concert needn't be something scary. And, you know, we used to sort of pretend that everybody wanted to be casual all the time and everybody wanted to be informal. I think younger people love getting dressed up and coming to a slightly more formal occasion. And, of course, Jacoby Symphony Hall is not always particularly formal. You can come to Symphony in 60, where it's only an hour long at 6:30. You can come to Symphonic Night at the movies. You can come to our pop shows and our classical concerts. So there's an enormous range of things to hear.
So what was the day like when you decided, hey, I want to be a conductor?
Let me see. I think I was about 12.
Mm-hmm. Because you have the one job, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but you have the one job that all of us have thought we have done at some point in our lives. We've all conducted something in the air.
I actually remember corralling my grandparents and family when I was eight years old on Sundays into the living room, and I would conduct them singing hymns before dinner. So it's always been there in my DNA for a long time. I think the thing that's so exciting about conducting is that when you play an instrument in an orchestra, you play that one part. And I played the clarinet in orchestras at university, but I always wanted to be involved with the piece in a kind of more total way, the whole thing, the cultural background, the stylistic understanding of the piece, the history of the composer. And also, you know, nobody realizes, when you conduct a piece of music, it just says on the page, fast or slow. It doesn't tell you what speed to go at, so you control the tempo of the music, and you have an enormous influence over the way the piece is received by the public. And that's a very exciting thing to be part of.
Do you connect individually with each person on the stage?
Yeah, pretty much.
And are there looks that you give if you hear somebody playing slightly?
Yep, they all know my looks very well. They all know the whole range of emotion from raised eyebrow to complete stank face.
What kind of looks are we talking about here?
Well, you know, sometimes sometimes people split a note and it's just an accident and you look the other way and don't go anywhere near. But if somebody's consistently getting something wrong, you know, first of all, you look at them once, get eye contact, then you might mention it, then you might have to stop.
You have a little raised
eyebrow. Yeah. And of course, it's not just correcting, it's also inspiring. You need to give enormous amounts of energy. You know, conducting is a good word because the experience of being a conductor is literally like being a battery into which somebody is sticking an electric plug, sucking out the energy. That is what you're doing. You're conducting energy to everybody around you. And that makes it very exciting. It also means that it's enormously energetic work.
And exhausting, I imagine.
And exhausting, yeah. I mean, after a day of two rehearsals, I can't really speak I have to just go to bed for a while.
And then, of course, later that same morning, we also spoke with Stephen Libman, CEO of the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra.
How are you continuing to fund all of this? The mayor talked about the $500,000 and the funding that likely will come through in the final budget. Yeah, we're waiting. The budget is not fully adopted yet, but that's the vision. And then obviously through a number of mechanisms. But how can you continue to build that as an organization?
First of all, we have very loyal patrons. And so most of our philanthropic support comes from individuals. We raise about $7.5 million a year, and a little over four of that is from individuals. We are blessed to have 1,400 households in the community that are just really, really generous to us. So that's not only our board of directors, but individuals, people give anywhere from $10 to a much higher figure. So that's the leading base. We also have corporations that support us. This community loves the Jacksonville Symphony. There are foundations that support us, and government agencies, as the mayor just mentioned. So we have cultural grants, and we have direct funding from the city. And if we're fortunate, sometimes National Endowment for the Arts. We would have had state funding, put a plug in here, but as you know, the governor eliminated all state arts council funding. We are now the only state in America without a state arts council.
Well, I'm looking out, and I see some chairs, too, that don't have little plaques on them. I think the one that I'm sitting in
does,
the
yeah.
Travis and yeah. Margaret Story chair. So I don't know if they're still with us, but thank you for your support. But there are some chairs out there that...
There are. There's hundreds of chairs. So there's 1,800 seats in the hall. And when this hall was renovated in 1995, the community came together, donated about $30 million to renovate what you see here and the Moran Theater. So the symphony was responsible for the complete renovation of this building, Jacoby Symphony Hall and the Moran. And as part of a donation, you could have a seat named after you, which was pretty cool.
We're going on, what, 30 years since that happened. So yes. What's the strategic future of this great facility then?
That's a wonderful question. So there's two answers to that. One is the city owns the building, so they are primarily responsible for the roof and the electricity and the air conditioning and all of that. The Jacksonville Symphony has most of the responsibility for Jacoby Symphony Hall, and we do have plans to replace the seating. It's beautiful, but if you sit in the seats... You hear that? Okay. That's like bone on bone in your hip. That's metal on metal, so those seats need to be replaced. Just about all of the seats have to be replaced, and we're hoping over the next 2 years we can do that. And we say now that there's a few seats that are Delta Comfort. Well, all of them will be Delta Comfort seats.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And because I have to do my plug for the symphony, for those not in the know, or I've been resisting my insistence that you should go see the symphony, the next show will be next weekend, which is the Best of Phantom West Side Story and more. Of course, after this, we start picking up a little bit more steam going out and about. A month after that, we sat down with Dr. Gail Patton, the CEO of Hubbard House, for the 30th annual Barbara Campbell Memorial Breakfast.
Everyone is busting out their purple from fall and winter because it feels
exactly.
like winter, doesn't it?
It does.
Like the one or two times a year we get to wear this stuff.
Yep.
Do you walk through the doors at this annual event feeling mixed emotions as well?
I do. It's a time of memorial, remembering Barbara Ann Campbell, remembering all those courageous victims who lost their life due to domestic violence. But then on the other side, there's hope. Because there also are people who are getting services and who are not dying because of domestic violence. And the hope also comes from seeing the community who come out year after year to say, we're here to support survivors. We're here to show them that we care. And what matters is that you are here and that we are here to support you. And that's huge because we can't, as you said, we can't do this alone. This is because Jacksonville is so committed to survivors. And this event shows that.
Who was Barbara Ann Campbell?
Barbara Ann Campbell was the sister-in-law of former Mayor Jake Godbold. And she had left her husband and was living away from him. And he found her and he shot her and he killed her.
And 30 years later, we remember her and all of the other women, men, children,
mm-hmm.
survivors of domestic violence, and yet it's her name that's a centerpiece. Why is that so important to Hubbard House and to the community that her name continues to be attached and affixed to this? And former Mayor Jake Godbold as well.
When this happened, this tragedy that happened to Barbara Ann Campbell and her family, Jake Godbold came to Hubbard House and said, we need to stop this from happening to other people. And we, him and the family, want to lend our name to your event to bring awareness that this can happen to anybody from any background and that there is hope and help available. And so, you know, as hard as it is for the family to relive this year after year, they do it because they know it's saving other people's lives so that other people and other people's families don't have to experience what they've had to live with now for all of these years.
And it's I don't want to say, it's inspirational to know that there are so many people here to help and that people shouldn't, victims should not live in shame, because this really touches all aspects of our society. So Barbara Ann Campbell, somebody who, you know, had a prominent family in the community, and this happened to her. And I think a lot of people feel embarrassed. They feel ashamed about this, and it can really happen to anybody.
It can, and you know, you really zoned in on something that is very common with this crime, and let's not make a mistake, this is a crime, and this is a crime where the victim feels ashamed and responsible, because that's what the abuser is telling them. You know, they're telling them, if you hadn't done XYZ, I wouldn't have to do this. This breakfast, we want to bring those voices to the forefront so that they see there's nothing to be ashamed of. And when we hear these stories of these amazing survivors and their resilience and their bravery to come forward and say, this happened to me, and I'm not going to live in the shadows anymore. I'm going to speak out so that others understand it's not their fault. It's not something to be ashamed of, that there are other people just like them who have gotten through this and are living very victorious lives and safe lives and not living without a voice anymore.